Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. In a moment, we'll present comments made by a local doctor during one of Governor Mike DeWine's regular coronavirus updates. Tuesday, December 1st, was World AIDS Day. Nearly 400 people in Ohio died of AIDS last year. We'll have an update on the virus and treatment in about 12 minutes. Then, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, Tracy Townsend takes a deeper look at the pandemic with the expected rollout of the vaccine and the impact the virus is having on schools and universities. And she'll have a conversation with former state health director, Dr. Amy Acton, who is now with the Columbus Foundation. And I'll wrap up the hour talking to Mary O'Doherty, executive director of the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. First up on Columbus Perspective, more than 5,000 Ohioans are in the hospital with COVID-19, and nearly a quarter of them are in intensive care. Dr. Andrew Thomas from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center talked about it this week on Thursday during Governor Mike DeWine's regular coronavirus update.
We crossed 5,000 COVID patients in Ohio's hospitals on Monday. Today, we're still over that mark at 5,141. Over 1,200 of those patients are actually in intensive care units around the state. As I talk to hospital leaders, doctors, nurses around the state, that's one of our biggest concerns right now. Many hospitals around the state have been able to increase their capacity for a routine, what's called a med-surg bed. That's kind of a routine bed where you might get IV fluids, you might be on some supplemental oxygen, and many hospitals are able to increase those numbers to a degree, but the hardest area for hospitals to increase their capacity or increase their number of beds is in the intensive care unit. You need very specialized staff, specially trained nurses and doctors, not just any nurse or doctor, but very specially trained respiratory therapists, staff to a level where they can help manage the patient's oxygen. I think we've discussed on these press conferences before the concept of proning a patient, where you actually lay a patient on their chest when they're on the ventilator, and you have to turn them back and over multiple times per day to optimize their lung function. That takes four people at a time in the room to turn the patient over and back. In those intensive care units, one out of every three patients right now has COVID. If that number continues to grow, that is going to crowd out the ability of non-COVID patients to be able to get the care they need in an intensive care unit. Hospitals do not have the capacity in an unending way to grow the number of ICU beds that they have. And what I hear on our daily calls is really that as our biggest concern, that at some point regional hospitals, community hospitals hit their cap on ICU beds, then they need to transfer to other locations. And at some point, those ICU beds at the other hospitals will be full. So with one out of three patients across Ohio in an ICU having COVID, in our rural hospitals, it's actually 50 to 60%. So more than one out of every two patients in the two rural regions of our zone that are in the ICU have COVID. That's not sustainable for those hospitals to be able to manage. At this point, hospitals around the state are making the difficult decision to postpone non-emergent surgeries and procedures. So think that neighbor who's scheduled to get a knee replacement or a hip replacement, or that friend from high school who needs back surgery for arthritis in their back. That's a major issue when those people, it's not an elective cosmetic surgery, but it's also not an emergency like an open heart surgery or surgery for a broken hip from a trauma, right? These are surgeries that can be delayed for a period of time, but it's still causing pain and suffering for those patients. It's causing delays in care, diagnostic tests that would potentially diagnose cancer might be delayed, other things. So it's really having an impact now as we see COVID patient numbers grow, that hospitals are making these difficult decisions to delay care. No one wants to see that. The big problem too, that we still have not yet to see the impact of Thanksgiving on our inpatient admission numbers. Thanksgiving was a week ago today, right? We are seeing people over the next 7 to 14 days that will be being diagnosed with COVID because they went outside their bubble to a social event. The timeline of when you're exposed, it's generally not less than 3 days before you would start having symptoms, but it's anywhere from 3 to 10 days where most people would develop symptoms. from that point, and so when you think about it, if you were exposed to someone on, say, Thursday or Friday last week, you're right now in that window where you might develop symptoms, where you may become positive, and then you're going to get tested, and you're going to find out you're positive. It's usually from the onset of symptoms to the time of needing to be admitted to the hospital. And most people being admitted to the hospital have the COVID pneumonia that we talk about. So they need oxygen for their lungs because they have pneumonia. That's usually about 7, sometimes 10, maybe even 14 days after the time they develop symptoms. And then once they're admitted to the hospital, most people, especially if they come in a timely manner, are not put on the ventilator in the emergency department, right? They're started on 2 liters of oxygen, but then by 2 or 3 days later, they're on 6 liters of oxygen. Then they're on high flow heated nasal cannula oxygen. Then they're on a mask that's tight on their face so that we can try to help them breathe, because the last thing we want to do is have to put them on the breathing machine. We found with these other oxygen delivery methods that we can reduce the need for people to need to be on the breathing machine. But from that period of time when you're admitted, it's about a week later on average where a patient would then need to be on the ventilator. And then that patient could be on ventilator for 2 weeks before, unfortunately, they may get so sick that they may pass away. So that we are just seeing the beginnings of people being tested, seeing the beginnings of the impact of Thanksgiving now. This surge that we're seeing is not about Thanksgiving. This is not the beginning of the end. This is not even the end of the beginning. We are in a really difficult spot here when hospitals are already at their highest COVID levels and at high capacity across the state. And we're just heading into what the CDC director has described as the most challenging 3 months of this pandemic. So I do know that the surveys are showing that more people are wearing masks. That's great. We need that. We need people to be committed to what they're doing at work or what they're doing at school in their personal life. That's the exact message we need people to understand, so that whether it's your neighbors or friends that might work in a hospital or someone you care for or love who needs to be in the hospital, you don't want to see them negatively impacted by the number of COVID patients crowding out other patients who really need care moving forward.
This is again Dr. Andrew Thomas from the OSU Wexner Medical Center talking about the coronavirus on Thursday. He was also asked about what it meant for Franklin County to go from purple back to red, whether that was good news or how much good news it is.
As we've described this color-coded map in the past, we've talked that some of the indicators are leading indicators. They look at rises or increases in the metric over time over the last 2 to 3 weeks. Some of them are the measurement of the current state of the outbreak, and then some of them are lagging indicators, especially the hospitalizations and the ICU flag. Now, those are ones, as we just described, the timeline of when you get this disease versus when you get in the hospital or the ICU, they lag behind the incidence in cases. Well, what I think we're seeing with going from purple back to red is some of those indicators that talk about the increase being the thing that triggers the metric, it's not that they are at low rates, especially the case number and the ED visit metric. When you're looking at ED visits, where people are describing COVID-like symptoms or viral-like symptoms, it's not like that's now at a low rate. It's at a high rate. It's just not a sustained increased rate at this time. So this does not mean by any means that Franklin County is out of the woods. We still have a rate of cases in the past 2 weeks in our county, which is 6 times higher than the definition of high incidence of infections per 100,000 people by the CDC. That is not good. We are not on our way down yet. We are still very high. Now, there are some changes that went on with testing last weekend because of the holiday, where some of our case numbers per day look a little down over the last couple of days. But I think that's more a feature of a number of the testing sites were closed over Thanksgiving. As I mentioned in my remarks earlier, I think we're just now through the weekend going to start seeing the impact of Thanksgiving in that spread. So going from purple to red is better than the alternative. However, it is still red. And I think that key metric, that first metric of cases per 100,000 people being 6 times the definition of high incidence, 6 times higher than the definition of high incidence by the CDC, is still very concerning to my colleagues. We were just talking about this morning on a phone call. that you know, we're still very, very concerned moving forward, even though a couple of the metrics look better. That lagging metric of ICU capacity and ICU utilization has flagged this week, and that's a huge concern to all of us.
Dr. Andrew Thomas again. He's with the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center.
Hey, this is Kevin Love from the Cleveland Cavaliers. At times, life can feel scary, which can leave us hurting and feeling overwhelmed with anxiety. Now, more than ever, we need to be kind to ourselves, kind to our mental health, and find some time and space in these tough times. Mindfulness is something that's helped me, and I hope it can help you too. My nonprofit is partnering with Headspace to offer you free content that can ease those feelings of anxiety. It's as easy to do as this. Take a big, deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. In and out. Just breathing. In and out. Head to kevinlovefund.org/headspace and be kind to your mind.
Donors choose. Support a classroom.
Build a future.
Did you know that every year, public school teachers spend nearly $500 of their own money for student supplies? Let's do the math. That comes out to over $1.2 billion a year. And that's just not right. At Donors Choose, we want students and teachers to have the tools they need for a great education. And now, more than ever, they need your help. Here's what you can do. Go to DonorsChoose.org and choose from teachers' requests that support reading, math, science, history, and more. Once a request is funded, we'll take care of shipping everything directly to the teacher. It's that easy. You'll receive thank you letters and photos from students and teachers and a report of how every dollar was spent. Teachers' needs have never been greater. Learn more at DonorsChoose.org.
Donors Choose. Support a classroom.
Build a future.
Still to come later in this hour on Columbus Perspective, Dr. Amy Acton talks about kindness. And we'll hear from the executive director of the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Hi, this is Dave James, and joining me by Zoom is Chip Lyons. He's the president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. How are you?
I'm well, Dave. Thank you very much.
Thanks for talking to us. Tell us about the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation.
We are an organization on the front lines of HIV and AIDS. It's advocates and policy advisors and service providers, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, and we are focused on ending AIDS children in youth and in families. That is an achievable goal, but as we've learned in this last year, pandemics are vicious, difficult things to battle. And so we continue to battle on HIV and AIDS, making terrific progress in so many ways, but set back because of this onslaught of COVID-19.
And this December 1st is World AIDS Day. What is the status of AIDS in Ohio as it pertains to the issues that you look at?
There are still new HIV cases, diagnoses in Ohio. There were about 1,000 in 2019. I think a point of real concern is that about a quarter of those are in people between the ages, young people between 15 and 24. And just to scope it out to the states, about 25,000 people living with diagnosed HIV in Ohio. The important point there is they have a diagnosis, they were tested, and they know their status, and they are on treatment. And when you're on treatment, you can live a long and healthy life. You are far, far, far less likely to transmit the virus. So you can get on with your life, with your family and your friends and your community. But if anyone is unsure of their status, they're tested, so they know where they fall.
And your concern with so many of those afflicted with it being young is giving birth when somebody has HIV, correct?
There is a substantial possibility of transmitting the virus during pregnancy, before the pregnancy, during birth, and then through the breastfeeding period. That chance reduces down to next to nothing, 1 in 2%, if the HIV positive, if a pregnant woman knows her status and is on the right medicine, almost no chance that she will pass that virus on. So she will have a healthy baby and a healthy family, and she'll stay on treatment herself to protect her own health.
If an infant is diagnosed with HIV, will drugs also make it manageable for the very young?
Yes, fantastic question, Dave. That hasn't always been the case. Movies, you know, always say women and children first. That isn't always the case in public health. Children have not had the same quality of testing services, nor sufficient medicine for their pills, for example. You can't, anyway, I won't try and explain that specifically, but you need pediatric specific formulations, and they've improved dramatically, literally in the last year. And literally this morning, I have news of a dramatic reduction in the cost for a year of treatment for a small child, for a newborn. So I couldn't have said those things 5 years ago. That's the kind of progress we're making. But I just want to remind us all, there's still no cure or vaccine for HIV and AIDS. So we have to be vigilant. We cannot let our guard down when we don't have a cure. We have to prevent and test and treat our way to controlling the epidemic.
You know, the excitement the world is feeling over these vaccines for COVID-19 are understandable. And this treatment of HIV that has developed over the last 10 or 20 years is on par with that. I mean, this was an equally frightening disease 30 years ago.
An even greater sort of death threat from contracting HIV, because there were no medicines. The improvements have been incredible, although at the same time, folks in this community kind of wish they had come faster, of course. Wish the costs were lower. Wish that there was a vaccine, but at the same time, you know, I get also asked, why is a COVID vaccine possible in 8 months and an HIV vaccine isn't? It's the nature of the virus, and the HIV virus mutates so fast. It becomes very difficult. It still is very difficult to. And I hope then we can continue our progress in battling that other pandemic called HIV and AIDS.
Talking with Chip Lyons, President and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. If folks want more information, Chip, how do they find out?
They can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. That's EGPAF, Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. We've got a terrific website, loads of good and interesting information and maps. And if this is meaningful work to you, we are supported by contributions and grants and so on. And so we would welcome that support if someone is so moved to do so.
Okay. Chip, thanks so much for your time today. Good luck with your efforts.
Thank you, Dave, very much. Good to be with you.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
Many employees unable to work because of COVID-19 related reasons may be able to take up to 2 weeks of paid sick leave and up to 10 more weeks of paid leave to care for their children whose schools or places of care have closed or whose daycare providers are unavailable. To find out if you qualify, visit dol.gov/FFCRA or call a trained professional at 866-4US-WAGE. This message is sponsored by the U.S. Department of Labor.
How do you know if you or a loved one is at risk of problem gambling? By knowing the signs, such as borrowing money, hiding unpaid debts, bragging about wins, or just plain irritability. Sound familiar? Get Set Before You Bet is Ohio's initiative to help keep gambling safe and responsible for everyone. How does it work? Just visit beforeyoubet.org to learn more and take the responsible gambling quiz. Together, we can keep gambling safe and responsible in Ohio. This message brought to you by Ohio for Responsible Gambling.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. Here's Tracy Townsend from her Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. Here's Tracy.
The countdown is on for the COVID vaccine to make its way to Ohio. Governor Mike DeWine announced a December 15th target date for the vaccine's arrival. 10 TV's Brian Somerville talked with a local expert who says a turnaround of less than a year for a vaccine is unprecedented.
After 8 months of a pandemic and a solid month and a half of hearing of a possible vaccine, Governor Mike DeWine announcing a date.
Looks like around December 15th, we will get our first batch. And we're very excited about that, or in the process of, you know, planning how that will get out.
DeWine says the first batch, assuming it's approved, will be from Pfizer. The second batch, a week later, would come from Moderna. The vaccine will take two shots about 3 to 4 weeks apart.
The good news now, Brian, is the light is on at the end of the tunnel.
Dr. Frederick Bertley, a president and CEO at COSI, has a PhD in immunology. He studies how viruses make us sick and vaccine development.
Never in the history of vaccine development have we put so many scientists and spent so much money to try to develop this.
He says what makes the coronavirus vaccine so impressive, the collaboration, locally, nationally, internationally. He also points out scientists were not starting from scratch, being able to look at other respiratory viruses as precursor candidates helping to develop these vaccines. And FDA-approved clinical trials, usually separated into three phases, were blended, helping to expedite the vaccine. Now, he understands some people might be hesitant for this vaccine, but he is not.
Would you feel safe taking it once it comes out?
Man, I'm first in line.
He also wants people to know the FDA assembles experts from around the country to examine carefully the data from companies like Pfizer and Moderna to study it and make a decision to release it.
People who are worried about government pressure and, oh, they're just going to approve it to fast track for political reasons. These are men and women like me and you that have nothing to do with the FDA or are not working for the government, but are experts in this area that are going to say yay or nay.
The state's distribution plan is expected to put a high priority on first responders like healthcare workers and nursing home residents and those considered high risk for COVID. With limited amounts available at first, Dr. Bertley says it could be next summer before it's available to the general public. But he says the fact 3 months ago there was no timetable for a vaccine, and now that one is expected in the next 3 weeks, that is something to be proud of.
More than ever, this should make society wake up and say, you know what? Science is really cool.
In Columbus, Bryant Somerville, 10 TV News.
Now, in order for the FDA to give emergency use authorization, it first has to receive the application. It requires at least 2 months of safety data, and a panel of outside experts then offers their opinion. The goal is that the vaccine has to be both safe and effective. Right now, the internet is full of misinformation about the vaccine. The Verify team looks into some of those claims.
With this pandemic, it's no doubt been a long year for everyone. And that's why we're all anxiously watching the latest vaccine news. And on social media, we've seen one question quite a bit. Who will get the vaccine first? And from there, what's the pecking order? Let's verify. Our sources are the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Who is most likely to get this vaccine first?
And Dr. William Schaffner, who spoke with our team on Facebook Live Thursday evening. Schaffner is a liaison representative for the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which is made up of medical and public health experts. The CDC makes vaccine recommendations based on input from this committee. Schaffner says the committee had a clear answer as far as who gets vaccinated first.
Healthcare workers, those individuals who have first contact with people with COVID or who might have COVID, will receive the vaccine first. This includes first responders. It includes people who work in nursing homes.
So healthcare workers are first, As for which group comes next,
it hasn't been quite decided. May be decided on Monday.
Generally speaking, the CDC says that there are three other groups being considered for early COVID-19 vaccination. They are workers in essential and critical industries, people at high risk for severe illness from COVID-19 due to underlying medical conditions, and lastly, those over 65. Dr. Schaffner says that there's still a debate about which group should go next.
Should it be people who are most vulnerable? Older persons, people with underlying chronic illnesses, they suffer disproportionately from COVID. Or should it be people who keep us constantly going in society? Long-distance truckers, the people who work in our pharmacies and our supermarkets.
So we can verify the consensus from the CDC's advisory committee is that healthcare workers should get the vaccine first. As for who gets it after that, that's still being debated. With your Verify, this is Evan Kozloff.
And while we wait for a vaccine, the number of cases and hospitalizations continues to rise, and it's only getting worse here in our state. Hospital leaders held a news conference with Governor DeWine to drive home the importance of wearing a mask and social distancing. As 10TV's Angela Reigert reports, what you do or avoid doing could change the course for our healthcare system.
It's not that we're planning for the surge. The surge is here.
Right now, at St. Rita's Medical Center in Lima, people with COVID-19 make up one-third of their facility.
The number of patients that are presenting that need hospitalization are coming in at a faster rate than we are discharging them.
Now combine the high number of patients with a dwindling number of healthcare workers. Doctors and nurses are getting sick, not at work, but in their communities. At Cleveland Clinic, hundreds of caregivers are either quarantining or actively fighting the virus.
When you have 970 caregivers plus who are out, that means it's starting to affect our ability to care for patients.
Hospitals are having to transfer patients from one facility to another solely because of space. They're also transferring ventilators because some hospitals are running out of them. In the next few weeks, we could see some medical procedures put on hold again.
Even to the point potentially of postponing ambulatory and outpatient office visits. We can't sound the alarm bell loud enough to the people of the state of Ohio to change their behavior.
Reporting in Columbus, Angela Reigert, 10TV News.
Now, at that same news conference, we heard from a mother who works as a respiratory nurse at Grant Medical Center. She's at home recovering from COVID-19, and she talked about feeling sick and how within 12 hours she could hardly breathe. 37-year-old Stephanie Marshall said she developed pneumonia in both of her lungs and knew right then she was in trouble.
They had to drop me at the door of the ER, which was the hardest thing because I knew how sick I was, and I didn't know if that was the last time I would ever see my family. And they dropped me off at Grant, where I work, and I was admitted, and they told me that I would have to be intubated because I was so bad. But I was at the hospital for 7 days. I was... It's really hard to be a COVID patient. I've been on both sides. I've cared for COVID patients, and then I've been there myself. It's hard to sit in a room that you can't leave the room, and the only people you see are in full PPE.
Marshall requires oxygen to breathe. She's the mother of a 7-year-old and a 1-year-old. Marshall says she's feeling better, but says she still can't play with her kids, which is difficult. State Mental Health Director Lori Chris tested positive for COVID-19. In a letter to her coworkers, Chris says she had minor allergy and cold symptoms and began to self-quarantine while she waited for her test results. She says her symptoms were light and that she's feeling better now while isolating at home. We did reach out to her for an interview, but she declined. One Ohio state senator is trying to spread the word you can get COVID-19 twice. Tina Maharath knows it firsthand. She just recovered from COVID-19 for the second time. Her quarantine period ended, but she says she's now only leaving her home for essential business. She's not sure exactly how she contracted the virus again.
The moment that the doctor told me I tested positive again, I was actually devastated. I was disappointed in myself because of the fact that I was indeed one of those individuals who did let my guard down. Because you know, being a highly regarded member of the community, they often view me as family. So at the Buddhist temple, they were saying, you don't need to wear your mask around me. You don't have to practice social distance. We're family. And even when we were at the family gathering with less than 15 people, it was the same message. We're family. You don't need to feel like you have to protect yourself from me. Well, the moment I let my guard down was the moment that I made my body vulnerable to this virus for the second time.
Senator Mahara says she's able to go back to work, but before she does, she has this message to her fellow lawmakers.
The lawmakers not wearing their mask at work, I urge you to wear your mask because of the fact that we're going to put our other colleagues around the state at risk. I work with colleagues around the state who are average age of 60 to 70 years old. Most of them have underlying health conditions. In order to protect not only your colleagues, but the citizens who do come in and out of state house, I just urge them to simply wear a mask. It's not that we're mandating you. We're just recommending you to, because we want to protect the public health of not only the state, but also amongst our own 33 colleagues.
Winter break is a little longer for most college students in Ohio. A breakdown of how the pandemic is impacting the start of spring semester.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors. This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Back to Tracy Townsend, courtesy of 10TV.
And we're back. Franklin County jails will not accept transfers. The jail has said fewer than a dozen COVID cases, but the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections has temporarily suspended the reception of inmates from Franklin County. This could also have an impact on the jail population and have more inmates asking for release. Hilliard students go all remote. 10TV's Krista Frost talking with the superintendent.
I'm very concerned about the mental health and well-being of our students as we shift to e-learning. It brings with it isolation and the potential for students to not have that human contact.
And Krista Frost also talked with a third grader about why she's hoping things get better.
This school year in the eyes of a third grader.
It's a little bit challenging, but it's also kind of fun.
You'll find good things and bad things, but what was once an obligation of going to school 5 days a week is now what Mara Watson looks forward to most.
I would rather be with my friends and my teacher because it's easier to, like, learn more from it.
She goes to Washington Elementary in Hilliard. The district was one of the few still in a hybrid plan, and her mom, Julie Watson, has been preparing to switch to all remote.
Mara, if we have to go back into e-learning, how's that going to be for you?
It won't be that fun.
But it's all for safety. Mom says the most difficult part is creating structure and motivation for her kids. And Mara, well, she agrees.
And I'd rather just to have, like, a actual piece of paper in front of me that I can do.
Is Mommy a good teacher?
Sure.
But it's not just the new learning they have to adapt to.
It's like a hard break. They don't get the chance to go say goodbye to their friends or their teachers. It's you're here one day, and then the next day, okay, you're gone.
In Hilliard, Krista Frost, 10TV News.
COVID-19 on college and university campuses means many families are getting bonus time with their college kids as traditional Thanksgiving break has extended to include the month of December and part of January. Administrators at The Ohio State University plan to watch coronavirus trends in December and early January, along with take guidance from Governor DeWine and state health experts. The first 2 weeks of spring semester classes will be offered virtually. That's January 11th through the 15th and January 18th through the 22nd. Student move-in for spring semester is currently scheduled for January 18th. University of Cincinnati administrators tell us spring semester is scheduled to open on January 11th, 2021. Adjustments were made to the calendar to reduce travel and the potential for the spread of COVID-19. Spring break will not occur as originally scheduled in March. Instead, two reading days have been added to the calendar, February 16th and March 24th. Crosstown at Xavier University, students will be back in person for the spring semester. A number of classes will be hybrid, but a spokesperson says that's because of class sizes and space. We're also told students are still experiencing an in-person classroom regularly. Students return on January 19th, which is 1 week later than originally planned, but they will still finish their semester on April 30th with exams from May 3rd through the 7th. Bowling Green State University indicates that, based upon current planning, Classes for spring semester will now begin on January 11th, 2021, and end on April 30th. BG is planning for the spring semester to be in person, so we'll watch that and keep you posted. The president and vice president-elects met with a group of mayors from across the country for a virtual discussion, and our own Columbus mayor, Andrew Ginther, was there, so to speak. Mayor Ginther says the group discussed some of the most pressing issues facing communities across the nation. He also mentions that it is, quote, critical that we have plans to efficiently and equitably distribute vaccines so we can keep our residents safe, get kids back to school, and begin our economic recovery. Mayor Ginther says he looks forward to working with the incoming administration on these important issues. President-elect Joe Biden addressed the nation, urging people to keep fighting against the virus.
I'm hoping the news of the vaccine will serve as an incentive to every American to take these simple steps to get control of the virus. There's real hope, tangible hope. So hang on. Don't let yourself surrender to the fatigue, which I understand it is real fatigue. I know we can and we will beat this virus. America's not going to lose this war. We'll get our lives back. Life is going to return to normal, I promise you. This will happen. This will not last forever.
Ohio's Republican senator says if the Trump campaign doesn't have any concrete evidence, it's time to move on. Senator Rob Portman wrote an opinion piece in the Cincinnati Inquirer saying, in part, it is now time to expeditiously resolve any outstanding questions and move forward. Up next, I talk one-on-one with Ohio's former top doctor.
I really feel that what we have yet is yet to come, and what we'll discover in doing this will heal us.
What Dr. Acton says every Ohioan needs to be doing right now. Plus, the 88 counties bus stops in Fairfield County. You'll see how businesses there are surviving the pandemic.
We are advocates.
We are defenders.
We are champions.
And friends.
We are the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
230 accredited members employing thousands.
All dedicated to the care and conservation of Earth's precious wildlife.
Sea turtles.
African penguins.
California condors.
Cheetahs.
And countless endangered species that are close to extinction.
See for yourself at aza.org/join us.
Or at an AZA accredited zoo and aquarium today.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Back to Tracy Townsend, courtesy of 10TV.
The surge in coronavirus cases and the fallout is a lot to take in. Ohio's former top doc says it's a moment for self-reflection and more. I talk with Dr. Amy Acton about the long-term commitment on the part of the Columbus Foundation that she says will be a very important part of this in the long weeks ahead.
What is Kind Columbus and why is now a great time for Kind Columbus?
Well, not a lot of people know this, but this was a project I had started working on before I got the unexpected phone call to work with the governor. And the Columbus Foundation has had a long commitment to trying to create sort of a flourishing community. You've probably heard of blue zones, places where people live a lot longer. And healthier lives. And so this was a long-term commitment, and kindness is a part of that. So for me, this was returning home to the work that I had begun. Mm-hmm. And kindness, you know, I've spent the last few months researching this, 3,000 years of history, all world religions, traditions, and what kindness really represents is these enduring community values that weave sort of the fabric of us. And as we can see now, are more important than ever. I think kindness is something that is science-based. I've worked a lot on looking into research in all sorts of fields, from positive psychology to you know, humanistic psychology to physiology of trauma and community resilience. And most recently working with Dean Byrne Melnick at OSU, we've been talking a lot about even the intentionality of mask wearing being a moment that we can be very intentional intentional about our kindness inwardly.
I think we're probably, it's safe to say we're going to see people who have never been in need before, now in need.
That's right. And, you know, and I just want to say something about that, you know, please reach out for help. You know, that's what our nonprofits are here to do. They live to do. And all of us are experiencing things we've never experienced before. As I've said, there is a contagion more insidious even than the virus. And that is, you know, what we're feeling, the fear, the uncertainty, and hardships that many of us are facing. But this, you know, this virus spread now knows no bounds, and we're seeing our hospitals. We're gonna see a humanitarian crisis, quite honestly, in a way we've never seen on our own soil.
All right, we've been taking you across Ohio, seeing our state in a different way. Today, the 88 counties bus is in our neck of the woods, specifically Fairfield County and the community of Pickerington.
Pickerington is about 20 miles east of Columbus. It's a great place to live. It's a great place to work. It's a great place to grow your business. 2020 has been a difficult year, obviously, for everyone. We think we've done a nice job managing 2020. We were able to pivot our economic development efforts to more of business retention and, quite honestly, business survival.
I am Crystal Allward, and we're at Porter's Coffee House and Bakery in Pickerington, Ohio. COVID happened in March. It totally changed everything. Obviously, we were like every other business owner in the whole country, just very worried about what the future would hold for us. We wanted to keep pushing on and just, you know, stay open as long as we can. We have a whole staff of employees that we were concerned about. The community needed us just as much as we've needed them. It's been a place where people have told us they are able to come here and keep a sense of normalcy, even though the ordering online and coming through the line and leaving might be different than what they're used to. They've made it work as much as we've tried to make it work. And I feel like without that, like, we wouldn't have been successful. I think it's really important for small towns and any place to support their local businesses. I mean, the local businesses, we are people from the community. We're people from the local area. We can relate to people in the area. I just think that we have more of a connection to who are coming in to see us.
Thank you so much for being here with us today. Remember, if it affects you, your family, and Ohio, we're here to make sure those accountable face the state.
That's again Tracy Townsend from her Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
In times of fear, World Vision has been there for the most vulnerable. For the last 70 years, we've stood with kids and families during some of the world's hardest times. Through natural disasters, war, and disease, delivering life-saving aid and support, helping rebuild lives, and empowering entire communities to lift themselves out of poverty. And we're doing the same today. Because rising to these challenges is in our DNA. And with every act of courage, faith, and love, at home and abroad, we do more than just stop the spread of fear. We replace it with hope. Learn more at worldvision.org.
Neil Armstrong waited 6 hours and 39 minutes to step onto the surface of the moon. Jackie Robinson waited 20 months to play his first game with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And even DiCaprio had to wait 22 years to win an Oscar. You can wait until your destination. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Hi, this is Dave James, and joining me on the phone, Mary O'Doherty, who is the Executive Director of the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. How are you?
I'm good this morning.
Thanks for talking to us. Give us a little bit of history about the Ohio Domestic Violence Network.
We are a coalition of Ohio's 75 domestic violence programs. We have members in almost every county across the state. Our members include about 57 residential domestic violence shelters, about 9 non-residential programs, and then several more culturally specific programs. And we exist to advocate for these programs and for the needs of domestic violence survivors before the Ohio General Assembly and with our federal representatives as well. So we advocate at the State House here in Columbus and also at D.C., in D.C.
Okay, and how long has it been around?
I think since 1989.
Well, I wanted to talk about domestic violence because we've been hearing a lot about the concerns that the pandemic and quarantining with families perhaps that aren't, you know, in the best of situations, that are kind of cramped up together during all this time, and that it might be exacerbating the problem.
Well, our members are telling us that in the early months when we were all staying at home, when the governor issued his stay-at-home order, our programs, many of them saw a decrease in survivors, a decrease in people coming to the shelters for help, you know, and that made a lot of sense because with the need for physical distancing, many victims, you know, especially those with children, were less likely to seek shelter. You know, we know for certain that it was more difficult and confusing for some victims when they went to court to ask for help. So at the beginning, when the stay-at-home order was in place, we definitely felt the impact. Since then, since the order was lifted, more folks are going to shelter and asking for help. But we are, one thing that we are seeing for sure is more of our programs are reporting an increase in the severity of the abuse they're hearing about from callers to their hotlines and then from the survivors who walk into their shelters.
It seems like it's just such a complex problem that's ripe for, you know, an increase, because you've got, in addition to close quarters with families that can make them weary of the situation, you've also got a lot of depression that's probably thrown into the mix as well, and that can add a lot of volatility, I would think, to those who would be prone to abusing others.
Well, history has shown that domestic violence increases in the aftermath of disaster, and with our economic turndown also playing a role,
right.
I think it's quite possible that we're likely seeing an increase in violence.
I would guess that when the numbers went down, that certainly didn't ease anybody's feelings that the problem was reduced.
Correct. That is absolutely correct. In fact, it was very hard for our programs and for our stakeholders to address, because we understood why survivors weren't going into shelter. You know, it made sense if you've got, especially if you have children, you've got, on the one hand, you have, you don't feel safe at home, but during a pandemic, I'm sure it's very difficult to decide to go into a shelter where you're in a congregate living environment, and it's very, very difficult to do social distancing.
Talking with Mary O'Doherty, she's the executive director of the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. How big of a problem is it in Ohio? Do you have some numbers on that?
Well, I can tell you how many people used our programs. Last year, more than 82,000 survivors, and that includes 12,450 children, sought help from our programs.
Wow.
You know, not all those people sought shelter. About 9,000 survivors actually went and stayed at our shelters, and about 3,800 of them were children.
So 80,000, that's, if I'm thinking of my math correctly in my head right off the top, it's like well over 200 a day.
Yes. You know, every year Ohio participates in a national census that is organized by the National Network to End Domestic Violence. And we always do the census in September. And the last time we did the census, we found that on that given day, 2,640 victims were receiving services at one of our programs. And And we also found that 263 victims could not be served because their programs lacked the resources. So there was no room at the inn, and 263 people couldn't be served on that census day.
Has the state or federal government helped with shelters or helping with any of the added problems that might have arisen?
Well, certainly. We are all benefiting from the funding that was included in the CARES Act, which was passed by Congress earlier this year. A significant bit of funding has come through right now. About $8.75 million was recommended to be paid to domestic violence programs and sexual assault programs across the state. They are eligible for up to $100,000 each to help with expenses incurred by the pandemic. Because it's CARES Act funding, the money has to be spent on COVID-19 related expenses, and we're helping our programs make sure that they're using that money as quickly as they can.
The world that surrounds domestic violence and caring for those victims and survivors, how much of a parallel course does it run with human trafficking?
Well, human trafficking is another, you know, very serious issue that involves interpersonal violence. Our shelters see a lot of human trafficking victims, particularly our programs that are in the northwestern part of the state. They report serving many survivors of human trafficking.
What about the number of shelters? I think we had done a story not long ago that there's more shelters that are coming to Central Ohio.
Residential shelters. There isn't one in every county, but we try our best to make sure that every county is covered. You know, if you're in a county that doesn't have a shelter in it, very likely there's a shelter in a neighboring county that can provide services. So we have a good infrastructure here. One of the problems that we have in Ohio, though, is that Ohio does not do a very good job providing regular operating support for its programs. Last year, in 2019, the General Assembly did pass a $1 million line item for the state's domestic violence programs, and we're very, very appreciative of that. That's funding that can be used by our programs just for general operating expenses, but it's far less than most states receive in state funding. For example, Kentucky's shelters receive $6.7 million a year. Indiana's shelters receive, I believe it's $5 million a year. Even West Virginia provides more funding in support for its programs. I think it's $2.5 million a year. So that's one of our challenges.
Talking with Mary O'Doherty from the Ohio Domestic Violence Network, when victims or survivors go to your website, which is odvn.org, a safety alert pops up to remind them that the computer might be monitored by the person that they're trying to get away from. And it's a whole different world that these victims are living in, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, in today's world, you have to worry, survivors do have to worry about being monitored. Their computer usage can be monitored. You know, devices can be placed on their vehicles that perpetrators can use to monitor their whereabouts. We have someone on our team who tries to keep up with various ways that perpetrators can victimize survivors using IT, using information technology. It's a very, very complicated issue, and it's one that's difficult to keep track of and keep on top of.
Are there any changes in law that your organization is advocating for? Or I know that you were involved in when the governor was releasing inmates. That was a concern of yours as well, right?
We were very concerned. We did talk to the governor about, we tried to talk to the governor, rather, and we did send information to his staff asking if he would consider releasing. There are women who are serving time now for, in connection with homicide and assault of their perpetrators. And we did ask the governor to consider releasing them early, but we were not successful in getting him to do that. We're very supportive of House Bill 3. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's called, another name for it is Aisha's Law. House Bill 3 would require law enforcement officers to do assessments at the scenes when they respond to domestic violence calls. They'd be required to do assessments to try to determine how serious the danger is, the danger level is. And House Bill 3, which is being sponsored by Representative Sarah Carruthers and Representative Jeanine Boyd, was passed by the House over the summer, and we are really hoping that it will be passed by the Senate and passed by the whole General Assembly before this session of the General Assembly completes its work.
During all of this talk about defunding police, which the movement is more about reappropriating responsibilities, I think, and there's been a move toward getting people who are more involved in mental health with responses to calls of domestic violence and things like that, so that we don't end up with situations where the police are confronted with a potentially dangerous person and somebody ends up getting shot. Is that something that would be beneficial, is if there was another network of counselors or therapists or mental health people that would be able to respond to these situations rather than police?
You know, I think there is always going to be a role for law enforcement when it comes to domestic violence. Very often, law enforcement are called either by victims or by neighbors or family members of victims. And often when that happens, people are scared. And very often when that happens, firearms are involved. So there will always be a role for law enforcement when it comes to responding to domestic violence in our communities. I do think we as a movement are considering the question of whether we are focusing too much on the criminal justice system as a way to help survivors. You know, many of us many of the folks who work in the domestic violence world think we should be spending more time helping survivors find housing or helping survivors become economically self-sufficient. So there's a big discussion happening in our society right now about the way we interact with law enforcement, and you know, there may be some changes in the future about this, but I think that we'll always be working closely with law enforcement at the community and grassroots levels.
It sure is a complicated situation because these survivors are people who are living in fear, unlike fear that most of us have ever known before.
Right. Yes. I think one issue for us, though, is that we want all survivors to be treated respectfully and with law enforcement. And one of the concerns is, are survivors of color given the same consideration and given the same, are their cases given the same level of seriousness? And so one of the issues that we're working on is trying to make sure that law enforcement works effectively with all survivors.
I remember talking to somebody once who said that somebody who's in a home with an abuser, and whether it's a person who abuses children or a spouse or anybody in the house, it's like being trapped in a house with a bear.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a terrible, terrible place to be. And you know, walking on pins and needles, not being sure what's going to happen if the bear gets disturbed. Yes, it's a terrible place for a survivor to be and for her children to be as well.
Talking with Mary O'Doherty, she's the executive director of the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. You've just wrapped up a fundraiser, but I know that folks can still help out online, right?
Yes, they can just go to odvn.org. There's a donate button. We are finishing up our annual fundraiser for our Life Saver Fund. Every penny that we raise through this fund goes to directly help survivors with assistance. We use these funds to help pay for utility bills, to pay damage deposits, to pay rent for a month or two. The whole point is to try to help survivors who are getting services and are shelters, get out, get on their feet, and start life anew.
It's outstanding. And folks can access your newsletter, and there's a lot of other information on the website as well.
That's right.
Mary O'Doherty, again, Executive Director, Ohio Domestic Violence Network. Anything else you'd like to add?
Nope. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM, that's 1460 ESPN Columbus, and Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM. Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.